Good evening, and thank you for this very special opportunity. I particularly want to thank the Foundation for the invitation to be part of this debate tonight. It is truly an honor to participate. We have been charged with promoting debate. I was born and raised on a small island on the east coast of the United States. That island is called Manhattan. I am a native New Yorker. Debate is part of my DNA, so I welcome this opportunity. I also point out that there is a hackneyed old adage that ours are two nations separated by a common language. I'm going to paraphrase that and say that our communities, the research communities, are actually two that are joined by some common issues and challenges. And I was encouraged, especially by Ed's slide, where he showed the respective placement of our nations on the specialization versus impact curve, and our nations virtually overlapped in that area. I say that because many of the issues that I will address, I address as an academic, being in charge of the full research portfolio at one of the larger state universities in the United States, but also with about two decades of government service. So many of these issues are particularly personal for me and have a personal bearing. I would argue that in both Ralph's and Ed's talks, you heard specificity with respect to the marine sciences, a wonderful way to lay the foundation for this upcoming debate. And many of my comments transcend beyond just the marine sciences. I think many of the issues and challenges and paradigms, if you will, that I'll express are broad in their applications and equally applicable to the marine sciences. The first thing to do is to take a look at our academic perspective. And the question is, how much have things changed? And probably with the HMS Challenger as the background, I'll start. In fact, with the age of the Challenger expedition, one could argue that it was the late 19th century when research as we know it, as we understand it, had started to grow into this dynamic enterprise that we now understand. And in fact, in the age of the Challenger expedition, it was really about discovery, understanding. We knew that there were many things we did not understand. We can argue about the objectives of many of these early expeditions, but ostensibly they were carried out with the quest for knowledge as the primary objective. From that, we got into a different era, and I'll just refer to it as the IUSS SOSIS CERTAS era. That is shorthand for the Integrated Undersea Surveillance System and the Sound Surveillance System, and CERTAS was the ship-based system. These are all part of the integrated acoustic system that was used during the Cold War for monitoring the activities of the Soviet fleet, primarily by the Allied fleet, by the American fleet, but in close coordination with our allies. And the point there, the brief history, is that how was this program set up? This program was basically set up by a set of United States Navy admirals going up to Cambridge, Massachusetts with a bag of money, saying, let's find the best researchers. And once they found those researchers, they said, we need you to build us a system that will help us detect submarines. That system was built in less than 2 years and became operational shortly after that. Think about that. How many operational systems of that magnitude, billions and billions of dollars, are developed from inception to operation in 2 years? It was a very different kind of research environment. We actually went from that back to this environment of the quest for knowledge. Early in my career, I worked for the Office of Naval Research. And when I worked there in the 80s, we were challenged to support the best research, no matter what the field. Ultimately, the expectation was it would have some value for the United States Navy. I'm reminded in that era of having at one point worked in a laboratory in Maine where we had a preeminent ocean chemist working on nitrogen cycling in the marine environment, and he was giving a local lecture in this small town in Maine. And one of the locals said to him, well, why do you study the nitrogen cycle? And he looked offended and said, You wouldn't ask a concert pianist why they play the piano now, would you? And back then, that was okay. The quest for knowledge was sufficient. The need to understand the nitrogen cycle in the sea was certainly something that was good enough in terms of justification for the research. We've gone beyond that. And right now, we are in this era of broader impacts. And you heard some of it alluded to, and I'll say some more of it, but you heard some of that alluded to in both Ralph's and Ed's talk. In the United States, I'll just put it in this context. The National Science Foundation, you saw their logo, incidentally, on some of Ed's slides. We work collaboratively across the pond. The National Science Foundation, years ago, just required that technical merit be the coin of the realm. Give me your best proposal, your most fascinating science, and that's what would be supported. After this quest for knowledge era, what happened was the National Science Foundation got more and more pressure from our Congress to justify why these investments were being made. And that even transcended into the political scene. Some of you may remember a few campaigns back when we had a presidential election, and one of the issues was, why was the United States government studying the DNA of grizzly bears? Were we concerned about paternity suits in the woods by bears? A particularly offensive posture for those of us in research who recognize that there's probably some fascinating biomedical outcomes from research like that. But nevertheless, the pressure was on, and the National Science Foundation progressively started building more and more requirements for what are called broader impacts. How does that research result in societal benefit? How does that research result in commercializable products? How does that research result in a diversification of the workforce? All good questions, but I remind you that in the US, again, we probably have about 20 mission agencies like NOAA, like the United States Navy, like the US Geological Survey. NSF is supposed to be the unfettered research supporter, if you will. And now, right now, when you write a proposal to the National Science Foundation, that proposal is equally weighed in terms of its technical merit and its broader impacts. That's a very interesting consequence. And what this means is that we're seeing some fundamental trends in research. And I would argue these are universally being seen, that government demands for return on investment will increase. I don't care if we're talking about how the government is spending euros, yen, dollars, it doesn't matter. The requirement for return on that investment has gone up. The other general trend that we're seeing is that the pace of technological innovation is being driven by sectors outside of the science community. Again, when I worked for the US Navy, we had mil-spec. Military specification was the standard. If you were going to build an acoustic system for marine technological applications, the military specification, in that case the US Navy specification, was what it had to meet. And that took a long, long time. Compare that now with the kind of specifications that Microsoft or Steve Jobs at Apple would apply, and how many generations one can go through in an iPad or an iPod or a Mac computer compared to what mil-spec was. So the market is driving the pace of innovation and therefore the pace of scientific research, much more so than the government. This means we're going to see a set of new paradigms. The new paradigms, I believe, are going to define how we do the kinds of things that both Ralph and Ed referred to in terms of adding value. One of the first paradigms we're going to see is that we are going to start commingling public and private funding. Right now, in the United States, that is patently illegal. And we work extraordinarily hard to separate those two efforts. Even if the objective is the same, you don't spend the money the same. Now, I compare this with what's happened, for example, in Finland, where I defy you to draw the separation between the public sector and the private sector in many investments that are made there. Soon, we're going to start to see that commingling. We're going to start to see crowdsourcing and citizen science. So the crowdsourcing is efforts like Kickstarter. Anyone in this room can put an idea up on Kickstarter, and identify a goal, and if you can manage to convince anyone who has access to the web to send you money, you could actually get your activity supported. Now, historically, this has been, Kickstarter's been around about 3 years, I think. Historically, this has been used for garage bands or for somebody starting up a tie-dye t-shirt business. I had a faculty member walk into my office about 6 months ago and say, I want to put my proposed research up on Kickstarter. What are our policies at the university for crowdsourced sponsored research? The only saving grace I can tell you is that at our university, on average, a professor will bring in about $300,000 a year worth of research, which is what it takes to run a research group with postdoctoral candidates and graduate students. Fortunately, right now, raising $300,000 on Kickstarter is not going to happen very quickly. So we have a little bit of time, but on the other hand, if there's a really good idea out there, we ought to be ready for it. Citizen science is another interesting idea, and I have to give credit to people like Bob Ballard, and I expect most of the folks in the room know or know of Bob Ballard, who did some wonderful undersea exploration work. And in fact, working with NOAA a few years back, he said, what I want to do is I want to make undersea exploration available to the world. And at that point, what Ballard was talking about was he would love to be able to put web access in real time to his next undersea exploration, which could be thousands of meters deep in the Black Sea or the Mediterranean. And what he wanted to do was basically allow researchers all over the world to drive the remotely operated vehicle. And when we asked, well, how are you going to do that when you have a million people involved? He said, you know, we can use the same software that they use on Dancing with the Stars. So you all get to vote. Should the ROV go over there and look at that black smoker, or should it go over there and look at that sea star? Really an interesting concept in terms of citizen science. Open source technology, you saw reference to that in both of the previous talks. This is a new concept where the sort of proprietary approach to software and technology is now opening up, and a group like OpenROV, which incidentally is a crowdsourced group, has all of their technology openly and available. This whole concept of protecting intellectual property is getting blown out of the water, and now you're probably going to be able to make your mark in the market by getting into the open source technology, getting a lot of people to use your technology instead of wasting time trying to patent and protect the intellectual property. Because by the time you do that, remember that Microsoft pace I was talking about? That technology is going to be out of date and will have been outcompeted by the next person down the street. The other paradigm, what I would call commoditized education and training. We have a metric in the United States. It's the six-year graduation rate. How many of our students that come in year one by the sixth year have graduated with an advanced degree? What we're finding is that six-year graduation rate is going down. It's going down at almost every university in the States. And it's going down because, and I find this very hard to believe, when I went to college back in the Stone Age, I was told, go to college, get a degree, you'll get a job, or you can go to graduate school. I wasn't worried about a job. Well, the economy's changed, and what we find now is students are going to school and saying, I need these courses, I need that accreditation, I need that certificate. The degree? Nah, I don't care as much about the degree. So how are we training up these students in light of this sort of commoditized education and training? Ad hoc networks of scientists and technologists. You're seeing it here right now. We collaborate and coordinate across international lines, across community lines. It's just as easy for me as a researcher in Corvallis, Oregon, to work with a colleague at Southampton as it is for me to work with a colleague down the road at the University of Oregon, 40 miles away. The technology is such now that we don't have to think in such a clustered fashion. And so many of the projects specifically that Ed alluded to involve extensive international collaboration, which is so much easier now than it was before. There's also this, and I would put this research by the pound concept in the same category as the commoditized education and training. So what we're starting to see is that the user community is saying, I would like a result that will give me this. So when the Deepwater Horizon blowout occurred 4 years ago now in the Gulf of Mexico, we didn't see as much of the research oriented around general understanding of ecosystem dynamics in conjunction with an oil spill, but rather we need to know exactly what the best predictive model is for the loop current and for how oil is entrained in the loop current and what the dispersants are doing, and we're willing to pay anything to get this piece of research done, which is, I would call that by the pound. We don't necessarily advance the understanding. We're solving the problem under those very specific conditions for that particular problem. Now, I remind you that we were asked to be somewhat provocative about the debate, so let me ask some questions. And this is the way I believe a debate should be conducted. It should be conducted in the context of what are the compelling questions and where are we going in the future. So the concept of technology readiness levels, or what in the U.S. Department of Defense we call the 6-1 through 7 funding categories, can that be sustained? If you follow the story of what James Cameron and his team did in the dive in the Mariana Trench, you see a story where the basic concept from initiation to development was done with a lot of adaptive management, was done with a lot of very creative thinking, was done with the amount of testing and evaluation that was needed to solve the problem, and was done in a way that is totally foreign to the way governments support development. And governments tend to support development with this technology readiness level hierarchy, or the 6-1 through 6-7 funding. Will academic research become increasingly beholden to industry? When I got to Oregon State University 4 years ago, 2% of our research profile was supported by industry. Right now it's 12%. Part of that is by necessity. The federal government is reducing its investments. The best quote I heard, many of you may recall, 10, 15 years ago, we talked about doubling the U.S. research budget. Well, the best quote I'm now hearing in Washington is, flat is the new doubling. And that's true, in fact. We're grateful when we see flat budgets, and then we get sequestration and government shutdown, so it becomes more and more difficult to sustain that, to feed the beast, if you will, by relying on government funds. So we start turning to private industry and foundations. But there's a price to be paid for that. And the price is that you become guilty of buying research by the pound, that you commoditize the research, that you become more concerned with the return on investment than with advancing knowledge. Part of this is, will hypothesis-based research become obsolete? The word research itself probably will become obsolete. Look it up in your favorite dictionary, and you will find that the scientific method involves first replicating the results of the previous experimenters. I defy you to show me any research proposal that is supported by a federal, by any government, that says the first thing we're going to do is redo what you just paid for last year. So the whole concept of research starts to become challenged. What about the peer review system? Is it going to collapse under its own weight? Ask any researcher in any country right now, and what you find is they're spending more and more time actually engaged in the peer review process. Because remember, that accountability's gone up, right? So now, where we were willing to tolerate some risk in the research, we do tend to be less risk tolerant. And as a result, what we're being asked to do is review with even more scrutiny that research. The example I will give you, 40 years ago, I was a graduate student. All of the support for my research came from one proposal that our group wrote to the Office of Naval Research once a year. When that group came in, when that team from ONR came to visit us once a year, they spent a week grilling us, asking questions, looking at the laboratory, and on Friday afternoon of that week, they announced how much money they were going to give us for the next year. That was it. We didn't have to worry about proposing. We were producing results. That was all that really mattered. When I tell that story to our graduate students now, they think I'm smoking something. This can't be real. This has to be a fairy tale. If you do a typical crosscut of researchers in the United States, you will find that they are writing at least 4 to 7 proposals a year and probably reviewing 2 to 3 times that many. That's a system that's going to start collapsing under its own weight. The good news is that physical place is going to be less important. We're going to see a lot more virtual research. We're going to see the capability to collaborate, the ability to telework, the ability to have telepresence. The interesting aspect of that exercise that Bob Ballard started materialized in the U.S. Office of Ocean Exploration, where for a period of time there was a program that was basically oceanographers without borders, in a sense, and it was a way for research to be conducted from a ship with access to experts all over, so that when you put the ROV over the side and you started to explore an area of the ocean that nobody had seen before, there were thousands of researchers back all over the world who had access to that real-time feed and could say, wait, stop, take a sample of that. We've never seen it before, and I know that because I'm the world's expert on that particular organism, geological formation, whatever it may be. So place is much less important. The last question I've got about the future is, what really becomes of exploration, monitoring, and observations? Very difficult to support in the context of this additional justification. It's interesting, we have this dilemma. We're in the era of big data, and the concept behind the big data era is that we should be collecting data, a lot of it, and from that we will learn a lot about the environment. But it's becoming increasingly difficult to justify the sustained observations, the sustained monitoring, and exploration is viewed as a nice to have, not a got to have. So that really begs the question of how will we go? Will we be able to support that? So I hope what I've been able to do here in these very wordy and eye candy-free slides is to convey to you some challenging aspects of what we're seeing in the research community in general, many of which manifest themselves in particularly emphasized way in the marine sciences. And I would argue they are not unique to any particular nation, but they can turn out to be insidious if we don't start questioning them and challenging them and engaging the public. And I suppose that's my final comment, is the way we address these new paradigms, the way we get to the future, is by having an engaged debate, not just with the captive audience, but with the person on the street, with the politician, with the business person, with the public in general. Thank you very much.